Hey, Morbidology listeners. Before we get on with today's episode, could I please request that you don't judge Morbidology on the early episodes? I'd recommend maybe listening from the newer ones backwards, because I honestly didn't find my feet in podcasting for quite some time. The quality of the early episodes, as well as the hosting, is not a true representation of Morbidology today, and I'm currently in the process of redoing them all. If you do listen to the earlier episodes, please don't judge the show on them, and maybe give a newer one a listen before deciding if the show is for you. Thank you so much for all of your support, and now on with the show. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Richard Ramirez, Randy Kraft, William Bonin, and Juan Corona. Now these names probably sound familiar to the vast majority of you, and that's because these men are some of the world's most infamous serial killers. They have a combined victim count of at least 75. Something else that they all share in common is that they all hail from sunny California. The Golden State is a breeding ground for serial killers. Fronted by white sandy beaches on the Pacific Ocean coastline, the land in California then rises into steep and treacherous mountainsides, replete with immeasurable varieties of trees and wildlife. California is vast and presents some of the most diverse landforms in all of the United States. Maybe this is why it's considered the perfect hunting ground and dumping spot for serial killers. In fact, Santa Cruz was once dubbed the murder capital of the world, with both Edmund Kemper and Herbert Mullen stalking and killing their victims here in the early 1970s. While many of the serial killers that hail from California are extremely well known, in the 1970s there was another serial killer lurking around the Golden State. And even more terrifying, he was never caught. In California in the 1970s, the hippie movement was rampant, and many flower children found hitchhiking to be the perfect way to escape their sheltered life and meet new and fascinating people and visit unfamiliar sites, completely disregarding the risks that they were taking. It's certainly easy to comprehend why hitchhikers are quite often a common target for serial killers. They put themselves in such high-risk situations. While hitchhiking was an extremely accepted method of travel in the past, it put people in a very dangerous and vulnerable position by making themselves so accessible to strangers.
I'm Lieutenant Williams, a police officer attached to the Juvenile Division. I'm on my way to Monroe Junior High School to talk to a group of young people. That looks innocent enough, doesn't it? Lots of young people hitchhike. Seems like a good way to get from one place to another. But sometimes there are dangers involved that never meet the eye.
In the late 1960s and early 1970s, a hooded figure that became known as the Zodiac Killer terrorized Californian citizens, claiming to have killed 37 unsuspecting men and women.
Search goes on in San Francisco for the man known as the Zodiac Killer. The elements involved today included psychiatrists, astrologists, and police guards for school buses. Terry Drinkwater reports.
School children are nice targets. I shall wipe out a school bus some morning, shoot out the tires, and then pick off the kiddies as they come bounding out. That was the threat of the Zodiac Killer. Now, every day, police cars follow the buses which would be likely targets. Officers armed with shotguns take the threat seriously. The psychotic killer has already murdered 5.
While the Zodiac Killer is virtually a household name, between 1972 and 1973, another unidentified serial killer was lurking around Sonoma County, California, just approximately 70 miles north of the bright lights of San Francisco. This twisted individual targeted unsuspecting young women and girls who were hitchhiking along strips of road before dumping their new bodies down embankments. The youngest victims were 13-year-old best friends who had just enjoyed an evening of ice skating, while the oldest was a 23-year-old married mother who was hitchhiking home for the Christmas period. This grim tale begins on the 4th of February 1972, when two 13-year-old Herbert Slater middle school students, Maureen Louise Sterling and Yvonne Lisa Weber, left the Redwood Empire Ice Arena in Santa Rosa, California. The ice rink was a popular haunt for adolescents and teenage girls. It was a Friday evening and the two best friends had been driven to the Redwood Empire Ice Arena at approximately 7:30 p.m. by Maureen's mother, Arlene. She had arranged to pick the girls up at the same spot at 11 p.m. that night when the ice rink was closing. When Arlene arrived to collect Maureen and Yvonne, they were nowhere to be seen. After they were reported missing by Arlene that night, a local man told police that he had seen the duo at approximately 9 p.m. They were walking along Guerneville Road with their thumbs pointed out towards the road. Why they decided to leave the rink early is shrouded in speculation. Maybe they weren't enjoying themselves, and as it was a brisk 8 degrees that night, they possibly decided that instead of walking home, they would hitchhike. Guerneville Road is just around the corner from the Redwood Empire Ice Arena, indicating that they had left the ice rink safely that night. But then, what happened to them? Maureen lived on Midway Drive, right beside the 320-acre stunning Haworth Park, while Yvonne lived on Holland Drive, beside the scenic Calvary Catholic Cemetery, overlooking Bennett Valley. However, Guerneville Road was in the opposite direction to either of their homes. After that confirmed sighting, they were never seen alive again. And almost a year would pass until what became of the two girls was finally uncovered. In the swinging 60s, hitchhiking had been widely romanticized. It had somewhat become the embodiment of freedom. Some thrill seekers saw hitchhiking as a fun and easy way to escape their mundane reality and create a new one just by hopping into a stranger's car and asking them to take them as far away as possible. Plenty of people believed that Maureen and Yvonne had just ran away to chase whatever teenage dreams they had fantasized of. But on Thursday, the 28th of December, 1972, it became apparent that this wasn't the case. Maureen and Yvonne weren't off chasing dreams. They were dead. Glenn Frost, who was just a teenager himself, had stumbled across the unforgettable scene. As he had been hiking through the deep and striking wooded hills that surrounded Franz Valley Road, Santa Rosa, with his 17-year-old friend, Dave Bruner, they spotted something peculiar lying around 60 feet down the grassy embankment that they were climbing up to reach their car to return home. As they stepped closer, they soon realized that the white object in the distance that had caught their eye was a human skull, defleshed and bleached from the elements. Laying nearby sat another skull and a human rib cage. The boy sped home to alert Glenn's father, who contacted police. When police arrived on the scene, they scoured the entire area and discovered the rest of the two girls' remains. It was indisputable that they had been out in the baking California wilderness for a prolonged period of time. The remains were virtually devoid of all flesh. All that remained of the two bodies were bones, teeth, and clumps of hair. An identity could not be made by vision alone. Whoever they were completely unrecognizable. No clothing or remnants of clothing was found at the scene. Presumably the two bodies were nude when they were dumped down the embankment. Nearby, however, police discovered a single earring, which consisted of a circular piece of what was once gold or brass with a lace-like pattern on the front, and orange beads hanging down below. Another police officer found a thin gold chain with a broken clasp. It had a basket weave design on the surface and the words 14K were engraved on the back. Sheriff Don Strapecki had the lengthy and tedious task of searching through all of the local missing person reports that had been filed. He was searching for a description of the two pieces of jewellery that had been found at the scene, but was unsuccessful in finding any that matched. Deputy Coroner Richard Adams received the remains and knew from the first look at the bones that identifying them wasn't going to be an easy task. As a matter of fact, their cause of death had been wiped away by time and could never be determined. A number of teeth were able to be retrieved from the scene, and a dentist was called in to create a dental chart for identification purposes. The new year brought new information when the two bodies were identified through the dental charts as Maurice Louise Sterling and Yvonne Lisa Weber. This made the young girls the 20th and 21st homicide victims in Sonoma County for the year of 1972. This was a stark difference from 1971, when there were only 9 reported murders for the entire year. As news of the identification broke, the girls' families felt resentful for police who had just shrugged them off as runaways. A memorial service for Maureen and Yvonne was held on the 27th of April, 1973, following which they were both buried at the Calvary Catholic Cemetery. While cause of death could not be determined, Sonoma County Sheriff Donald Strapecki announced that they were investigating the case as a homicide. Investigators had theorized that the killer had thrown the two bodies from his car at the top of the embankment, where they then rolled down to the location they were found. Due to the condition of the remains, it was theorized that Maureen and Yvonne had been killed shortly after they disappeared. Just a month to the day after Maureen and Yvonne disappeared from the ice skating rink, another young girl with her whole life ahead of her disappeared under similar circumstances. 19-year-old Kim Allen was a Santa Rosa Junior College art major and Ursuline graduate who coincidentally lived on Guerneville Road, where Maureen and Yvonne were last spotted attempting to flag down a car. When Kim disappeared, the bodies of Maureen and Yvonne had not yet been discovered. In fact, Kim's slain body would be found before theirs just the following day after she went missing. In her spare time, Kim worked at Larkspur Health Foods on 460 Magnolia Avenue. At approximately 5 p.m. on the 4th of March 1972, Kim finished her duties at work before she pulled on her knee-length beige coat and grabbed her orange backpack and departed the store to hitchhike back to her home in Santa Rosa. She was also carrying a large wooden barrel filled with soy sauce. Larkspur Health Foods was around 42 miles away from the home Kim shared with a few girlfriends. As Kim was strolling down the street with her thumb in clear view of passerbys, two men pulled up alongside her and told her they could take her as far as San Rafael, which was only about 3 miles away. It was better than nothing, she thought, and hopped in. The two men later told police they dropped her off at a northbound on-ramp at Bell Avenue and Highway 101 at around 5:30 p.m. She thanked the two men for the ride and sauntered off into the evening lights of San Rafael, never to be seen alive again. Her parents and teachers had frequently warned her about how dangerous it is to hitchhike, telling her that you just never know who you could be getting in a car with. But Kim always saw the good in people. The following afternoon, Montgomery High School students John Bly and Scott Bunting were riding their motorcycles when they pulled over along Enterprise Road between Bennett Valley Road and Sonoma Mountain Road, approximately 8 miles southeast of Santa Rosa. This was at around 2 p.m. as the two teenagers stood at the edge of the road and glanced down into the creek bed at the bottom of a 20-foot embankment. They spotted something that they initially thought was a discarded mannequin. Soon, they realized that what they were observing was actually the naked body of a woman lying face down in the creek bed, not a mannequin. Investigators soon arrived and cordoned off the scene to search. As the new body was hauled off to the mortuary, investigators observed scratches all over the woman's body, suggesting that the killer had hastily thrown her down the embankment before speeding off in his car. Almost immediately, the body was tentatively identified as Kim Allen, from a photograph that was given to police by Kim's roommates. They had become concerned when she hadn't returned home from work and reported her missing. She was subsequently identified in the mortuary by her sister. Sonoma County Coroner Andrew Johansson uncovered that the cause of death was asphyxiation and that she had been killed around midnight on the Saturday she disappeared. He also revealed that she had essentially been tortured to death. The killer had slowly strangled Kim with a cord. The pathologist approximated that it took Kim at least half an hour to die. Binding marks on her wrist and ankles indicated that she had been tied up in a spread eagle position. Due to the evidence of restrainment, it isn't much of a surprise that the coroner revealed that Kim had also been raped. Semen was recovered from her vagina. While investigating the crime scene, police observed a mark in the grass at the top of the embankment, adjacent to where Kim's body had been found. It appeared as though somebody had slipped and fallen down the embankment. There was another impression in the grass around 10 feet down the embankment, presumably made by whoever had slipped down. Considering the position of the scuff in the grass, it seemed likely that it was the killer who had slipped when throwing Kim down the embankment. The headlines the following morning in the Press Democrat read, "Lawmen say woman's killer could be injured." Detective Sergeant Timothy Brown said that it was possible that the killer may have sustained an injury, serious enough that he would have required medical assistance. With the murder now in their hands, police scurried about and signed virtually the entire detective bureau onto the case. Meanwhile, 12 Sonoma County Sheriff's officers were assigned to retrace Kim's steps after she arrived in San Rafael. They hadn't yet found her clothes, her backpack, or the large soy sauce barrel she was last spotted with. As a matter of fact, those items would never be recovered. Within days, posters of Kim Allen's face decorated the walls of Santa Rosa University's, urging people to come forward with any information they may have about her slaying. The two men who gave Kim a ride to San Rafael that night were brought in for painstaking questioning and then given polygraph tests. Police soon announced that they were not considered suspects in Kim's murder. At the request of Kim's father, Kimball Allen, a memorial mass was held for Kim on the 11th of March at the Ursuline High School's boarding residence. Kim had lived here throughout her high school years until she graduated in 1970. She had many fond memories at the school. She served as senior class spirit leader and had been granted a big sister role to one of the younger students. Therefore, it seemed like a fitting place for the memorial mass. As Kim was known to be a vivacious and positive character, the memorial was more of a celebration of her life as opposed to a somber event. As a matter of fact, Kim's sister, Annalie Shannon, relayed that Kim had recently been speaking about death for whatever reason, and had mentioned that when she passed away, she wanted it to be a beautiful ending for a beautiful life. However, the reminder that she was taken from the earth in such a brutal way, and the killer was still at large, was constantly playing on everyone's mind, regardless of how uplifting the memorial was. A reward fund was established to go towards whoever could provide information that could lead to an arrest of the fiendish killer. Meanwhile, a Kim Allen Memorial Scholarship was founded at the request of Kimball. It was to go to a future boarding student at Ursuline. He said, "I want some other girl to enjoy what Kim enjoyed at Ursuline." There wouldn't even be a month's intermission until the killer set his sights on another habitual Sonoma County hitchhiker. In 1970, Jeanette Camahel graduated from Yokohama American High School in Japan and then enrolled in Santa Rosa Junior College. It had always been Jeanette's dream to live and study in America. She wanted her own piece of the American dream. The 20-year-old Pacific Islander beauty lived with her roommate, Nora Morales, at 951 Sierra Avenue in Cotati, and would frequently hitchhike the 10 miles to and from school each day. It was a mild spring morning on the 25th of April, 1972, when Jeanette lifted herself out of bed, freshened up in the shower and pulled on her favourite pair of blue Levi's jeans, a brown sweater and a pair of sandals. She put on a pair of gold post-type earrings, grabbed her leather purse and left her apartment to stand beside the on-ramp off Highway 101, which was just a few blocks from her home. It was here that Jeanette would often catch a ride to school. As she stuck her thumb out to the road, her friend in the distance spotted her. Before he got a chance to pull over to give her a lift to school, the car in front stopped beside Jeanette and she hopped in. He later told police that the car was an early 1950s model brown Chevrolet pickup that had been fitted with a homemade wooden camper, and the driver was a white man around 20 to 30 years old. Jeanette disappeared into the morning sun and was never seen again. When Jeanette didn't return home that evening, her roommate Nora called around to see where she could have been. Her stomach sank when she was informed that Jeanette hadn't appeared to any of her scheduled classes that day. Jeanette had no reason to run away. She was getting good grades and she had a steady boyfriend and lived with her best friend. Nora immediately called police, who issued an all-points bulletin the following day. Jeanette was described as 5 feet 5 inches tall, 120 pounds, with brown eyes and black hair. In addition, Jeanette had some unique identifying features, including a dental bridge and a birthmark beneath her right breast. The bulletin also described what she was wearing on the day she disappeared and gave a phone number to call if anybody had spotted her or knew anything about her disappearance. The news of Jeanette's disappearance reached as far as Oregon, with the Oregonian running an article which offered reward for information which could lead to her safe return. Following Jeanette's disappearance and the murder of Kim, both Santa Rosa Junior College students, a number of concerned fellow students founded a carpool program in a bid to reduce the number of women that were hitchhiking to and from school. This program linked students who had cars with those who lived nearby that didn't have a method of transport. Even though the girls and women of Sonoma County were being warned of the dangers of hitchhiking, that didn't mean that they all took heed to the cautions. 13-year-old Lori Lee Cursa was an 8th grade student at Lawrence Cook Junior High School, who lived at home with her mother, Lorene Cursa, on Dolores Lane in Santa Rosa. Lori was a perpetual runaway and hitchhiker, so when she disappeared while shopping at USAF with her mother on the 11th of November 1972, Lorene didn't initially begin to panic. Lori was going through her teen angst phase, and this was a common occurrence. Nevertheless, Lorene called police later on in the afternoon to report her daughter missing. It would be over a month until Lorene saw her daughter again. However, when she next saw her, it would be to view her body in the mortuary. On the 14th of December, a young couple were enjoying a leisurely walk along the top of Calistoga Road, just northeast of Rincon Valley in Santa Rosa. The time was 3:30 p.m. when they spotted the naked body of a female lying beside some trees at the bottom of a 30-foot embankment. For the past couple of weeks, the weather had been extremely bitter. Thus, the petite body, with chipped nail polish, was frozen solid. She was estimated to have been out in the open air, anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks. An autopsy concluded that she had suffered dislocation of the first and second cervical vertebrae, which caused compression of hemorrhage of the spinal cord, resulting in death. Even though her body was nude, it was established that she hadn't been raped. The killer presumably tossed the body down the embankment, where it rolled before being stopped by a grove of trees. She was believed to have still been alive when thrown down the steep embankment. Dr. Harry Muggeridge identified the body as Laurie Lee Cursa by her dental records. She had been disposed of just a few short miles from where Maureen and Yvonne's bodies were found. Police again made an appeal for anybody with information to call their anonymous hotline number. A secret witness program was also set up and included a $500 reward. If somebody knew something but was too afraid or nervous to come forward, they were told to write it down on a piece of paper and then rip the corner off that piece of paper. They would then have to sign both pieces with a number combination. If the information could lead to an arrest, then the secret witness would call police hotline to reveal their number combination. Police especially wanted to speak to anybody who had seen or spent time with Laurie in the past month, so that they could determine her whereabouts from the time her mother last saw her to when she ended up discarded down an embankment. Several of Laurie's friends told investigators that she had been staying with them after she had run away from home on the 11th of November. She was later spotted in Santa Rosa with a group of friends on November the 20th or 21st. It was likely that Laurie was killed shortly after this final reported sighting of her. As the news of the grim discovery made headlines in Santa Rosa, a man called police to inform them of something suspicious he had witnessed. He didn't think anything of it at the time, but after reading about the body of Laurie being discovered and seeing her photograph in the newspaper, he thought it best to call police. He told them that he was driving home from work at approximately 9:30 one evening early in the month of December. He couldn't quite remember the exact date. As he was approaching the corner of Parkhurst Drive, which is just off Calistoga Road, he noticed a white van parked at the side of the road. In the driver's seat was a white man with an afro hairstyle. When he turned the corner, he saw two other men walking alongside a young girl. They appeared to be holding her up. He told police that the two men then ran across the intersection with the young girl and then threw her into the white van that was waiting nearby before speeding north onto Calistoga Road. The van looked old and battered, as if it had been in a wreck, and the driver's door was off-coloured, the witness recollected. On the 21st of December 1972, while most families were wrapping up their loved ones' Christmas presents and adding the final touches to their Christmas tree, Lorraine and her ex-husband Homer laid their youngest daughter to rest. The service was held at Egan and Lance Mortuary, following which she was buried at Santa Rosa Rural Cemetery. While the atrocity of such a young girl being brutally murdered was still fresh in citizens' minds, news that the bodies of Maureen and Yvonne had been found wended through the streets of Santa Rosa just the following week. The talk of a serial killer began to quiver in the air. In the space of 1 year, 4 young hitchhikers had been killed and then thrown down embankments in the same vicinity of one another, with another young hitchhiker going missing under similar circumstances. It was evident that this certainly wasn't a coincidence. Another young Californian hitchhiker and habitual runaway was 15-year-old Carolyn Davis. She was a 9th grader at Anderson High School, which was just a few miles away from her home, in 17600 Olinda Road, where she lived with her mother Rose and her father Lauren. Seemingly bored with living at home, Carolyn decided she was going to run away. The last day her parents ever saw her was on the 6th of February, 1973, exactly 1 year and 2 days after Maureen and Yvonne disappeared. Carolyn got up that morning, pulled on a pair of faded blue jeans, and teamed it with a dark brown jacket with a fur collar. She had already decided that she was running away when she woke up that morning. She wanted more than what Anderson could offer her, even at such a young age. She packed a bag and scurried off into the sun at approximately 7 a.m. By 6 p.m. that evening, Rose and Lauren had reported their youngest daughter missing. Shortly after she ran away, she sent a letter home, in which she explained that she had left voluntarily, and she didn't want her parents to search for her. She didn't want to return home, she said. On the envelope of the letter was a stamp from Soledad, California, which was approximately 320 miles away from their family home in Anderson. The teenager had frequently expressed her desire to visit San Diego, so her parents assumed that's where she was heading to. However, Carolyn never made it as far as San Diego. Randall Appel was riding his motorcycle along the Franz Valley Road on Tuesday the 31st of July 1973, when a pungent smell wafting in the air made him grimace. He pulled over to the side of the road and decided he would investigate. While searching the nearby area, he spotted something discarded along a steep embankment on the other side of the road at around 8:30 p.m. He recognized the area immediately. It was exactly the same spot that Maureen and Yvonne had been found just the previous year. Almost as if history was repeating itself, he soon figured out that what he was staring at was a putrefied naked body, lying face down in the ravine, not 4 feet from the exact same spot where Maureen and Yvonne were found. Investigators had to hold off the initial search of the area surrounding the girl's body until morning. By the time they arrived, it was far too dark. One of the first things they noticed the following morning was the positioning of the body. The unidentified body was around 20 feet down the precipitous embankment, but she was behind a cluster of small trees and brush that had not been disturbed. This led investigators to believe that the killer was a strong and burly man that was able to lift the body up and throw it over the shrubbery as opposed to rolling it down the embankment, like he had done with the previous victims. Now, there was no scepticism that Sonoma County had a serial killer lurking among their Equitable residents, and he was taunting them. The spectre of a sadistic killer was looming over Sonoma County, while an attempt at identification of the most recent body that had been found was still underway, as well as a cause of death. It wasn't an easy feat due to the decomposition that had eroded her physical features. The pathologist estimated that she had been dead for 10 to 14 days, and District Attorney John Hawks released a physical description of the girl, who was described as being between 14 to 16 years old, with blonde, brown, shoulder-length hair. Identification would come the following week, when a young woman from Anderson called the police to inquire about the body after reading about it in the news. That young woman was Carolyn's older sister, who agreed to send over a copy of Carolyn's dental records. It was a match. Carolyn didn't make it to San Diego, and she wouldn't be returning home. Her grandmother came forward to tell police that she had last seen her granddaughter at around 1:30 p.m. on the 15th of July, when she drove her to the post office in Garberville, which was over 100 miles away from where her body was later found in Santa Rosa. Her grandmother said that Carolyn had planned on hitchhiking to Modesto. Santa Rosa is directly in between Garberville and Modesto, leaving investigators to speculate that Carolyn's killer had offered her a ride. The secret witness program that had been used before was implemented once again, and this time there was a $2,500 reward for any information that could lead police to the killer. The search of the area surrounding the body produced no clues, nor did it turn up her missing clothing. Meanwhile, the autopsy and toxicology report finally had a cause of death for Carolyn. Strychnine poisoning. Strychnine is an odorless poison that is derived from the seeds of the Strychnos nox vomica plant. It is most commonly used for killing pests, and as a subject in many murder mystery novels. Other than that, it very rarely makes an appearance in the modern world, and certainly never used as a method of murder. After injection, ingestion, or inhalation of strychnine, the first symptom of poisoning is painful muscle spasms. Exposure to high levels of the poison would result in respiratory failure and can cause death within 15 to 30 minutes, if lucky. However, if exposed to a lower dose, the victim could experience a variety of other horrific and painful symptoms, including severe seizures, heightened sensory awareness, stiffness, and agitation. The seizures can last up to 24 hours and can result in other symptoms, including hypothermia, kidney failure, respiratory acidosis, and finally, death. So in short, strychnine poisoning is an agonizing and sometimes slow death. Carolyn suffered greatly. It was determined that the strychnine was either in sulfate or tablet form, indicating that it had been administered to Carolyn orally or intravenously. The autopsy couldn't verify if Carolyn had been raped or not. She was laid to rest on the 18th of August at the Lawncrest Cemetery in Reading. By now, police had finally named a suspect, 27-year-old Albert Richard Verhees. He was a hulking man standing at 6 feet tall and weighing over 300 pounds. He had recently been charged with the June 1973 murder of a man from Sonoma while visiting the coastal town of Jenner. Additionally, he was also suspected in 3 sex murders in Colorado and Virginia. After placing Albert in Santa Rosa around the 18th of July, which was around the date that Carolyn Davis was murdered, Detective Irwin Carlstead flew out to Golden in British Columbia, where Albert was being held so that he could question him in relation to the string of unsolved murders in Sonoma County. Quite frankly, they didn't have any other leads to go on, nor had they since the first body was discovered. While Albert denied any involvement in the murders, police would soon come to believe that he was telling the truth. The Santa Rosa hitchhiker killer would soon be back, but this time with even more barbarity than before. The oldest hitchhiker to fall prey to the elusive hitchhiker killer was 23-year-old Teresa Walsh. It was the run-up to Christmas of 1973, and Teresa had picked out all the perfect presents for her 2-year-old son, Danran, and on the 22nd of December, she was planning on hitchhiking to her family home in Garberville. It was family tradition to spend Christmas together, and her husband Denny would be meeting her there. Danran lived in Garberville with Teresa's mother, Goldie Smith, while Teresa lived approximately 10 miles north in Miranda. She pulled on a pair of white bell-bottoms, a lavender blouse, and a brown fur coat, which she topped off with an olive-green Boy Scout knapsack, and made her way to the golden shorefront of Zuma Beach, located beside Malibu, where she had been visiting friends. After chatting to some friends, she set out hitchhiking home for the festive period. When she didn't arrive home in time for Christmas, her family became worried and reported her missing. She wouldn't have missed Christmas or let her son down intentionally. So where was she? Mark West Creek begins in the Mayakamas Mountains in Sonoma County and flows through the Laguna de Santa Rosa, where it then drains to the Russian River in Forestville. Not only is it a popular area for whitewater kayaking, but it's also a very scenic area, boasting of vineyards and ecologically protected areas. In addition, it supplies clean drinking water for over 600,000 people in 3 California counties, as well as a diversity of wildlife. 2 teenage boys set out for Mark West Creek on the 28th of December 1973, rubber kayak in tow. They were floating down the creek when they noticed something in the near distance, bobbing up and down in the water, seemingly not gaining any traction. Whatever it was, it looked as though it was stuck on something, rendering it unable to meander with the flow of the creek. When they approached the unidentified floater, a fetid smell that would linger for days wafted up their nostrils. It was a dead body, partially submerged under a log. It was a strenuous task to reach the body's location. It was very deep in the long and winding creek. In their four-wheel drive car, Lieutenant James Caulfield, Sergeant Butch Carlstead, Sergeant Ed Wilkinson, Deputy Oliver Del Ponte, and Captain John Heese rambled their way through the thick underwood surrounded by large oak trees and evergreens. 2 hours later, when police finally got to the location that the boys had described, they lifted the body from the murky waters with the aid of ropes. The sight would scar even the most hardened police officers that were at the scene. It was the nude and hogtied body of a young woman. Her arms and legs had both been bound against her chest with a clothesline rope in a crude fashion. Her thumbs had also been bound to one another, and a noose was knotted around her neck, so that if she struggled, she would be strangled. An autopsy performed by Coroner Richard Adams determined that the young woman had been strangled to death with a rope approximately 1 week before her body was discovered. In addition, she had been raped. The coroner also said that she had suffered a severe blow to the back of the head with a heavy object and had a large bruise over her left eye. Mark West Creek flows for over 29 miles, and police couldn't conclude exactly where in the creek the killer had disposed of the body. The treacherous landscape surrounding the creek made them conclude that the killer hadn't carried her too far, but had most likely driven up one of the dozens of roads that lead to the creek and then pulled off alongside the creek, where there was sufficient space to do so. Along the banks of the creek were high water marks which indicated that the creek could have been at least 6 feet deeper over the past week. The body could have been dumped anywhere and subsequently travelled several miles down the rough waters. The young woman, who had not yet been identified, was described as being between 18 to 25 years old, 5 feet 5 inches tall to 5 feet 7 inches tall and 120 pounds. She had long, dark locks that were once full of volume and brown eyes that were now sunken into her skull. There was also an identifying feature which could set her apart from any other missing person cases. She had a set of false upper teeth with a gold crown on one of her lower teeth. Over the forthcoming day, several people called police to give details of their missing loved ones to see if they matched the features of the nude body. It would be almost 2 weeks until the young woman was identified. Garberville police handed over Therese's missing person report to Sonoma County Police, who then compared the fingerprints of the deceased woman with Therese's fingerprints that had been recorded by the California Department of Motor Vehicles. The bound and naked body found in the creek was Therese. The secret witness program was now up to a $9,500 reward for any information that could lead to the killer. As these young women and girls were being murdered, the media focused more so on the higher profile killers, such as the Zodiac Killer or Edmund Kemper, who had both been active around the same period.
In 1972 and 1973, a series of murders shocked Northern California. College girls began to disappear while hitchhiking. Two of the victims were picked up from the campus of the University of California at Santa Cruz. That's where Ed Kemper's mother was working as an administrative assistant.
You were involved in the campus because your mother worked there.
Yes. I was also involved in killing co-eds because my mother was associated with college work, college co-eds, women, and had had a very strong and violently outspoken position on men for much of my upbringing. My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her. She had terrible pain from her life, earlier life, her upbringing, a failed marriage with my father. I'm a constant reminder of that failure. I hate to distill it down into such, into one word, realities like that. There's a lot that leads into that happening, but that is what happened. They represented not what my mother was, but what she liked, what she coveted, what was important to her, and I was destroying it.
The Sonoma County hitchhiker killer certainly didn't garner as much attention, and maybe that's why he successfully eluded capture. As a matter of fact, shortly after Teresa's body was discovered, police began to look into the possibility that maybe the Zodiac killer and the Sonoma County hitchhiker killer were the same person. However, the modus operandi of both killers varied substantially. The Zodiac killer killed both men and women, and they were found either shot or stabbed to death. None of his victims were ever strangled or sexually assaulted, nor were they ever discovered nude, like the majority of those associated with the Santa Rosa hitchhiker killer. However, Sheriff Don Stripeki said, "The last messages we got from the Zodiac indicated that he was going to continue his killings, but vary them. And he bragged about collecting slaves for his use in the next world." In 1969, the Zodiac killer sent a letter to the San Francisco Chronicle, in which he said that he was going to make his next string of murders look like routine robberies, killings of anger, and a few fake accidents. The Zodiac killer was known to taunt police by frequently sending them letters, bragging about his indiscriminate murders and mocking their inability to capture him. He also sent several letters which contained cryptograms, some of which still remain unsolved today. He boasted of killing 37 people in these letters, but police were only ever able to confirm 5 of these murders. After announcing the possibility that the Zodiac killer and the Santa Rosa hitchhiker killer were the same person, Sheriff Don Stripeki revealed the police had found a strange symbol made of sticks on Franz Valley Road, where the bodies of Maureen, Yvonne, and Carolyn had been found. Sheriff Don Stripeki believed that the symbol was associated with the occult. Zodiac experts in the San Francisco area were skeptical of this theory. Homicide detective William Armstrong said, "While we can't disregard it totally, we do not see any striking similarities with our cases here."
It has come down to this: an emergency request to the U.S. Supreme Court for a stay of execution in the case of Theodore Bundy has been rejected this evening. The vote was 5-4. Bundy is scheduled to die in Florida's electric chair tomorrow morning at 7. There may still be some last-ditch legal maneuvers that could cause yet another delay in the execution, including an appeal for clemency to the governor of Florida. But just by way of background, since 1925 in Florida, there have been 202 appeals for clemency, and only 6 have been granted. And Governor Bob Martinez, who will have to make that clemency decision on Ted Bundy, has already indicated that he wants the execution to take place. Indeed, Bundy's murders, those for which he is being executed, there are 3, and at least 20 others to which he has confessed, have made his execution a rather popular event.
It could be argued that Ted Bundy is the world's most infamous serial killer, having killed at least 36 young women and being the topic of many true crime books, movies, and documentaries. Before his execution in Old Sparky in 1989, investigators were trying to uncover just how many women Bundy killed. Some he confessed to, some he was more reluctant to speak freely about. They announced that they estimated his victim count to be 36, in which he cryptically replied, "Add another digit." Could Bundy have been implying that he had hundreds of kills under his belt? Since his arrest, and even long after his death, Bundy has been suspected of a number of unsolved murders all throughout the United States. The Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders certainly match Ted Bundy's modus operandi, even down to the physical appearance of the victims. Bundy's preferred method of murder was strangulation, and he had a penchant for targeting young women with dark hair parted down the middle. Coincidentally, the victims in Sonoma County all had dark hair, parted down the middle. Bundy had also confessed to investigators that he had, in fact, killed one unidentified woman in California. Additionally, Bundy had attended Stanford University in 1968 and had visited his girlfriend in California between 1968 and 1974. Could Ted Bundy have been the elusive hitchhiker slayer? Sonoma County Sheriff Detective Sergeant Mike Brown certainly believed so. He said Bundy was looked at as a very serious suspect. However, if Bundy's credit card details are anything to go by, it seems highly unlikely that he was the perpetrator behind the killings, as his records placed him in Washington throughout the murders. Nevertheless, ex-detective Robert Keppel, who interviewed Bundy several times, noted that Bundy often drove hundreds of miles to pick a target. He very plausibly could have driven to Sonoma County and then back to Washington in the space of a few days. Investigators were never able to definitively link Bundy to the string of murders in Sonoma County. Furthermore, Bundy would quite often knock his victims unconscious with a heavy object before strangling them and was known to commit necrophilia, even returning to the decomposing bodies for several months. Maureen, Yvonne, Kim, Lori, Carolyn, and Teresa all had their lives cut tragically short due to lack of transport and a romanticized portrayal of something as precarious as hitchhiking. In 1979, skeletal remains were discovered approximately 100 yards from where the body of Lori was discovered 7 years earlier. The body was of a young woman who had been hogtied with rope around her neck, feet, and hands, eerily similar to how Teresa had been found. Police initially believed that the remains may have been those of Jeanette, saying that the body had been there for around 7 years. However, dental records proved otherwise, and the body was never successfully identified. Was this another victim of the Santa Rosa hitchhiker killer? Due to the location of the body and the lewd ropes binding her, it certainly seems most likely. Jeanette has still not been found to this very day, but it is believed that she fell victim to the same killer. So who picked up these girls on that fateful night? From the elusive Zodiac killer who was never identified, to one of the world's most infamous and well-known serial killers, Ted Bundy. Suspects have come and gone over the forthcoming years, but still, the murders remain unsolved. From the soaring redwood forests and snowy mountains in Northern California, to the white sand beaches and the arid deserts of Southern California, the Golden State certainly varies in landscape, just as much as it varies in serial killers, who slashed, stabbed, shot, poisoned, and strangled their way to earning the macabre title of the murder capital of the world. Well guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy Morbidology and want exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, please feel free to join me on Patreon. You can join for as little as $1 a month and cancel any time. You can also sign up annually and save 15%. Big thank you to everybody who has simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode. All of the support is very much appreciated. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.